Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing pressure on Saudi Arabia as it becomes increasingly clear that the impetuous, arrogant, and violent Saudi Crown Prince, known as MBS, ordered the grisly assassination of a critic employed by the Washington Post on Turkish soil. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the uncomfortable predicament President Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner find themselves in because they are so close to the young Saudi leader they have championed, in spite of his reckless and catastrophic war in Yemen and his ill-considered and unsuccessful blockade of neighboring Qatar, demanding that the Qataris shut down their influential Al Jazeera network. We will assess how effective Turkey's intelligence service, the MIT, appears to be based on the leaks of a lot of information incriminating the Saudis, and conversely, how sloppy the Saudis have been. We will also address the larger issue of the competition underway in the Islamic world between Turkey, which champions their version of political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the medieval monarchy Saudi Arabia clings to while propagating their reactionary, austere, and xenophobic Wahhabi version of Islam. Then, with the grounding of the world's most expensive weapons system, the F-35 fighter, and the release of a GAO report that some of the most expensive and cutting-edge weapons in the U.S. military's arsenal can be easily hacked, we will speak with the primary designer of the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet, Pierce Bray. He joins us to discuss the essential fraud that stealth technology is, since the Russians, using World War II radar, can easily detect our aircraft, which costs so much more to both buy, fly, and maintain, with the F-35 the ultimate example of a military-industrial complex boondoggle. Then finally, we'll speak with Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and co-author of the new book just out, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. He joins us to discuss how the internet has become the new battlefield of the 21st century as we enter a frightening future where the truth is the first casualty as fake news becomes a non-kinetic but violently manipulative and effective weapon in hybrid warfare, which Russia has pioneered using tools invented in America. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage, an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So it looks like two U.S. allies are at loggerheads, although Turkey is late, even though it's a NATO ally, has been a bit shaky, and the U.S. does not have great relationships with Erdogan. And Saudi Arabia, conversely, the White House, particularly President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have very close relationships with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who seems to be a very impetuous, if not a very violent person, a person who doesn't think things through. He impetuously started a war in Yemen where there's no end in sight. He blockaded Qatar with no end in sight. And now it looks like he's pulled off one of the most brazen acts imaginable, which is not just to kill the Saudi dissident in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but to chop him up and ship his body out. Presumably that's what happened. That's what the Senator Corker seemed to say today, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So there's a lot of political pressure being put on President Trump at the moment. It's a pretty extraordinary situation that such a brazen act could have taken place.
Well, it is. I also think it's sort of typical of, I think, our human reactions that the horror of the story of the murder and dismembering of a Saudi journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul is more horrifying to us than say, the deaths of tens of thousands of Yemenis under horrible circumstances of starvation and disease in a feckless war there that you just referred to. But so, yeah, ironically, the killing of this one person may figure more prominently on the political horizon, U.S. and Saudi horizon and Turkish horizon, than the ongoing terrible war.
So what's happening with all of this information that we're getting, obviously being leaked from Turkish intelligence officials, and Erdogan himself, when he was visiting with a fellow autocrat in Hungary, Viktor Orban, he demanded the Saudis find the tape of Jamal Khashoggi leaving the consulate. He was very close to the royal family. Then he went abroad, became a sort of dissident, had a job with the Washington Post, and U.S. intelligence apparently intercepted Saudi officials talking about kidnapping him in Virginia and renditioning him to Saudi Arabia following the orders of MBS. So that in itself is a smoking gun. So it looks like U.S. intelligence and Turkish intelligence are leaking a lot of information. Is the MIT, the Turkish intelligence service, that good?
Yeah, the Turkish intelligence service has a very high reputation. Obviously, the Turkish state, which goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, has been honing these skills in running its own empire. But yeah, I think the way the information has been leaked makes it very clear that at the absolute minimum, Turkey has coverage from the outside of the building, and on top of that has very likely both audio and, who knows, even video surveillance on the inside of the Saudi consulate. The fact that they are not directly admitting that, but certainly doesn't take much imagination to perceive that. The fact that they're going this far really suggests that they want to deeply embarrass Saudi Arabia, even if President Erdogan himself does not want to have to be delivering that bad news.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest, Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. So conversely, could you say then that the Saudis are pretty brazen, if not sloppy?
Well, I incline more towards the sloppiness of the issue, but who knows? Maybe they thought these days that they can get away with anything because of the huge clout that they enjoy, both financially and because of their oil reserves. But still, I tend to think it's more brazen. They may not really have thought that anybody was going to be able to follow up very easily or care that much about it. But I think what this does is rekindle a much more serious, longer-term geopolitical struggle and ideological struggle between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Yes, they've disagreed over aspects of Syrian policy and the war in Syria, et cetera. But I think this goes way back and much deeper in the sense that particularly Erdogan and his AKP party that's now been in power for, I don't know, 15, 16 years, has a vision of Islam in governance, which is essentially based around more modern values. Yes, we can very much criticize Erdogan for what's increasingly autocratic behavior on his part, but nonetheless, there are still elections in Turkey, and they matter hugely. And Turkey, I think, sees more modern, if you will, contemporary movements like the Muslim Brotherhood as representing the way the future, as I said, of Islam in governance will be. The Muslim Brotherhood, after all, itself is an organization that has, party headquarters. They've got publications. You can visit them. You can interview them. They run for political office. Indeed, the Muslim Brotherhood won the first election in Egypt after the fall of Hosni Mubarak and the Arab Spring in 2011. So, I think what really rankles with the Saudis is that the Muslim Brotherhood and its workings within the trappings of democratic governance to one degree or another is very alien to Saudi Arabia. They don't like that. They don't like the more modern interpretation, relatively more modern interpretation of the Muslim Brotherhood than the very austere and narrow xenophobic views of Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia. So I think these are two contrasting views of how to think about Islam in terms of the modern state, and I don't think it's going to get better or go away.
Well, you mentioned the arms deals and the clout that they have over being the huge supplier of oil. Today, President Trump, in sort of waffling about what he was going to do, if this is proven, which I think it's pretty close to being proven that this was ordered by MBS and there's going to be some consequences. He said, well, you know, we got over $100 billion in arms deal, which, of course, is an exaggeration. And that means a whole lot of jobs, you know. And if we turn that down, the Russians and the Chinese will just move in and sell their military hardware. So,
And that's been also the British rationale, who have been equally selling weapons and helping support the Saudi UAE war against Yemen. But you know, I think Trump likes to play all sides of this. The U.S. talks about Saudi Arabia being an ally, whatever that means. At the same time, Trump has delivered some really quite insulting and demeaning remarks towards the King Salman, and saying that, you know, you guys wouldn't last more than 2 weeks if we withdrew our support with you. It suggests really nothing more than a kind of a rich banana republic. So I think Trump is going to be happy to pocket the gains of catching the Saudis out in a really very ugly situation and use it to his own ends to manipulate, to force greater concessions out of Saudi Arabia on a whole variety of issues, all the while benefiting from selling them guns and weapons.
Well, we know that Jared Kushner tried to shake down the Russians for money for his building on 666 Fifth Avenue, and he also apparently tried to shake down MBS and the Qataris. So I don't know whether, you know, most of the interpretation of what's happening now says this situation with Saudi Arabia is a black eye for Jared Kushner because he's so close to MBS. But you're saying something quite different.
Well, I think there's a difference perhaps between even Jared Kushner's position and Trump's position on this. In the end, Trump wants to be able to manipulate Saudi Arabia as best he can. And I think Kushner is partly working to maybe benefit his father-in-law, Trump, but at the same time wants to retain these relations. In any case, I don't think President Trump will hesitate to use this against Saudi Arabia and to extract further benefits out of it. And Turkey, in the meanwhile, is going to be Turkey. Turkey is long since, I mean, over 20 years now, really, has been increasingly independent-minded in its view of its role in the region. It doesn't really consider itself to be an ally, a U.S. ally, whatever that means. It means that they're simply not going to do the bidding of U.S. In the region anymore in the way that it used to do, say, in the 20th century. So I think we see quite a number of daggers drawn here, opposite people working on opposite sides of very complex issues that involves Russia and Syria and everything else. But nobody, everybody is going to gloat over the weakening of MBS in Saudi Arabia. Simply, whether they want to work with them or not, it weakens the Saudi hand.
Well, apart from the ill-fated, impetuous war against Yemen that MBS started and doesn't know how to finish except by unbelievable cruelty, and he's created the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet, and that's really saying something. He also made this impetuous move against Qatar, and that, I think, gets to back to the Muslim Brotherhood dichotomy, doesn't it? The Emiratis and MBS hate Qatar because of their ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, but more importantly, because of Al Jazeera, that they're putting out a message to the Arab world that they can't control the Saudis because they obviously have enormous censorship and control over their own people. And my understanding is that MBS wanted to invade with Qatar, which was an easy military task, but the only thing that stopped him was the fact that there were Turkish troops there deployed as a tripwire.
Yeah, well, as you know, Turkey hastened to send those troops, perhaps fearing that exactly that kind of thing would happen, and the Qataris were very willing, indeed anxious to have them there as a safety device to protect them. But yeah, I mean, this goes further to what we had just been talking about earlier of differing views of the Middle East, of the kind of governance that should be there. Yeah, Qatar is not a democratic state, but it has a pretty enlightened, one of the most enlightened ruling families, I would say, in the region. You know, it's going in very much for Western arts. Al Jazeera is an astonishing institution in that it pretty well broadcasts the truth about what's going on in the Middle East, except it doesn't criticize Qatar, the state itself, but everybody else comes in for discussion and analysis. So that is very much the future, I think, of what the Arab world would hope to be, not narrowly state-controlled, dominant government, state-dominated media forms. Anyway, so yeah, I think Turkey and Qatar, quite some way back, both felt that they were on the same wavelength in understanding a more progressive. Yeah, it's not as progressive as we would like, certainly not Erdogan even now, but much more progressive than the really medieval kind of mentality and structure that we see in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I find it extraordinary how gullible our press has been about MBS with all of these Valentines from Tom Friedman in the New York Times, 60 Minutes, etc. What a great reformer he is. Here he is kidnapping the Prime Minister of Lebanon, not just what he just apparently did in Istanbul with this grisly murder of a dissident, but his people kidnapped a woman, an activist, a Saudi activist who was promoting the right of women to drive cars. She was kidnapped in Bahrain and taken out. I mean, it's amazing. And here he is getting all this credit for letting women drive. But, you know, he's going after everybody. Reformers, I think, are on top of his list. But now, according to this character that was just, looks like he's just killed, he's also going after anybody in the elite. If you say something wrong at a dinner party, if you make fun of him, you know, it's worse than Stalin. You're likely to end up in a prison.
Well, this you're exactly right on this, Ian. And I wonder how long Saudi political culture is going to be able to put up with this. There's increasingly bad blood between that immediate, MBS's immediate branch of the family and all the other people who have been humiliated, their wealth, however ill-gained, nonetheless their wealth, stripped away from them or extorted out of them. Who knows what kind of security arrangements there are within Saudi Arabia to protect MBS, but he is operating increasingly in a very hostile environment with all kinds of people, I'm sure, within the royal family and beyond, very anxious to remove him. He's broken all the rules of how Saudi domestic politics proceeds. I'm sure there's a price to be paid at some point.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, the former Vice Chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul Station Chief and is currently a Professor of History at Simon Fraser University. And he's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest, Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the grounding of the world's most expensive weapon system, the F-35 fighter, with the primary designer of the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. And he left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pierre Spray.
Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Pierre. And I wanted to get your opinion on what's happening with the F-35 fighter because of the whole fleet's been grounded, and that includes the planes that have already been sold to Israel and the UK. We've talked about it before when it was in development with a massive cost overruns as the most expensive weapon system in the world. So what's behind the grounding and the recent crash?
Well, I think the grounding is of no consequence and has no bearing on whether it's a good or bad airplane. The reason for it is they had a fuel leak, presumably, they think, from a badly manufactured fuel tube in the engine, and the pilot had to eject. I would guess that probably the airplane caught on fire at that point when he ejected. But that doesn't prove a thing about whether the airplane's good or bad. You know, all airplanes have crashes, and the crash rate per se of the F-35 isn't appalling at all. It's quite good. That doesn't mean it isn't going to kill a lot of pilots in combat because it's extremely vulnerable to the smallest kinds of bullets. It's so stuffed full of flammable fluids that it's like an explosion waiting to happen. But that's in combat, which is, what we really care about. This peacetime safety incident is, I think, neither proves that it's good nor bad. It's just it had a crash, but its crash record is pretty decent, more than decent. It's unusually good. In fact, I was always surprised how well they were able to avoid peacetime crashes. That doesn't change the fact that the airplane was designed to do close support, deep strike bombing, and air-to-air, and is miserably poor, miserably ineffective at all three missions for very clear reasons that have to do with, the terrible way in which the airplane was first conceived and designed.
Well, nevertheless, the crash, the one that crashed, cost between $80 million and over $100 million. And
it cost far more than that. They're burying all kinds of costs.
Uh-huh. What would you estimate then the planes have?
This is the F-35B, which is the jump jet, the one that takes off in short takeoff and does vertical landings. It's the Marine Corps airplane. It's much more expensive than the Air Force airplane. That's already, which is the F-35A, and that's already too expensive. If you count in all the fixes that are still remaining to be done. Remember, this airplane is like a do-it-yourself kit. When it gets delivered, it's full of all kinds of defects that still remain to be fixed, and it has to keep on going back to the depot to have repaired structural members and repaired engine parts and repaired electronics installed. When you factor in all the costs that they haven't admitted to yet, this airplane will cost well over $150 million, probably closer to $200 million.
Well, one of the statistics that's alarming enough is that it cost roughly $50,000 each hour to fly the F-35, whereas the plane that you designed and developed, Pierre, the F-16, costs around $10,000 per hour to fly.
No, not quite $10,000. It costs around $20,000.
$20,000.
Right.
So,
right.
But there's a considerable difference to between $20,000 and $50,000.
Yes, and for obvious reasons, because, you know, the F-35 has all kinds of electronic complexity that add tremendously to the cost and actually hurt the combat effectiveness.
Well, my understanding is all of this stealth technology, and that includes the F-22 and the B-2 bomber, has been incredibly hyped. Because of the stealth characteristics, it means that these planes are not aerodynamic. And furthermore, the Russians have the radar, the long-wave radar, that goes back to the Battle of Britain, which detects these planes. So isn't the whole thing a fraud?
Indeed. That's exactly correct. It's the right word to use. From the start, you know, long before we put the first stealth airplane together, even the predecessor of the F-22, the F-117, we knew that long wavelength radars would detect it. And of course, we also knew that the Russians would be working on other means than just radars, like passive detection means, which they're very good at. And both they and the Czechoslovakians have been developing passive detection gear that's totally immune to stealth. That was to be expected, and to bet and so heavily on a technology that probably added 30% to the cost of the airplane, if not more, and doubled the amount of maintenance. Stealth coatings require enormous amounts of maintenance, and that ruined the performance of the airplane aerodynamically relative to what it could be. This was a ridiculous decision, but it was a decision that was very simple to make because it added a lot of cost and it had one huge greater advantage, which is why Bill Perry, who was at the time the head of R&D in the Pentagon, pushing stealth, I mean pushing it like crazy. And the reason he was pushing it was A, because it added a lot to the bill and he was a big industry shill, and B, had the advantage that he could make it highly classified. And that was kind of a brilliant stroke on his part. We'd been doing stealth work, building on what the Germans had done in World War II from 1946 on. It was always at a low classification level. It was at confidential level. I did some work on it when I was in the Pentagon because I was very interested, more for small boats than for airplanes where it had better application. But the brilliance was, once he recognized that he could add billions to the defense budget on the strength of stealth, he then classified it, not just top secret, but beyond top secret, into code word classification where you had to have special access and very few people had access. That was brilliant because that meant nobody could look over his shoulder, so they could phony up all the tests they wanted to because nobody had the clearances to check the test data. And, of course, the test data, if it had been realistic, using actual long-wavelength radars, would have immediately shown that stealth was pretty worthless.
Well, the other story that I wanted to touch on today is that we've just learned that some of the most cutting-edge weapon systems in the U.S. military's arsenal can be easily hacked using basic tools. This is comes from a GAO, Government Accountability Office, report finding that mission-critical cyber vulnerabilities in nearly all weapon systems tested between 2012 and 2017, and that, of course, includes the F-35 jet that we're talking about. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, in this age of the internet and electronics to have weapon systems that could be hacked into. I mean, for example, if you're firing a missile at the Taliban in Afghanistan and somebody could hack that guidance system so it blew up a wedding party, you'd be in big trouble, right? I mean...
As the Iranians did with one of our drones, they actually misguided one of our highly classified drones and caused it to land in Iran so they could copy the design.
Right.
That actually happened. I mean, that was a fair while ago.
It was a fair while ago, but the U.S. lost an enormous amount of technology in that plane.
Well, I don't know that they did. I don't know that it was worthwhile technology. It was certainly highly classified.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it was worthwhile.
I understand the distinction, but my understanding is that they had the latest radar that means that you can when you turn on your radar, it's like turning on a flashlight in the dark. So the latest radar it had was that you couldn't detect that you had radar, which would be a massive advantage, surely.
I don't think there was any compromise of radar per se.
Right.
What was compromised was the stealth technology that was built into it,
uh-huh.
and the reconnaissance sensors that were in it. But radar wouldn't have been one of those that was of any consequence.
Okay. Well, I defer to you.
The basic proposition is entirely correct. As we complexify these weapons and fail to test them, you know, rigorously for whether they can be either hacked, you know, you use the word hacking kind of loosely, everybody does, whether they can be either countermeasured or whether their actual communications with satellites or with the internet or whatever can be literally hacked. Either one requires rigorous testing, rigorous and honest testing, that allows people who are smart, as smart as our enemies, to devise whatever they want to see if they can, you know, whether they can neutralize the weapon, either through internet hacking or through jamming or through other countermeasures. We don't do that. We do phony testing. We do not allow free play use of intelligence that our enemies are capable of in order to try to tell whether a weapon's worth putting into combat or not. I mean, there are simple things like there are weapons that can be countermeasured by simply taking a microwave oven and turning it on, you know, with the door open and a switch to make sure it stays on, you know. And the Yugoslavs did that to us. They actually countered some of our stuff using those kind of simple jammers. You know, that was perfectly knowable in advance. We could have tested that and known before we ever flew against the Yugoslavs. We don't do it because it threatens the budget. It threatens all that good money flow to the contractors. So there's no question that the GAO report is right, and probably right to a much larger extent even than the GAO thinks.
Well, let me just give you some of the bullet points from the GAO's report, and you can assess whether that's bad enough. The Pentagon did not change the default passwords on multiple weapon systems, and one changed password was guessed in 9 seconds. A team appointed by the GAO was able to easily gain control of one weapon system and watch in real time as the operators responded to the hackers. It took another two-person team only 1 hour to gain initial access to a weapon system and 1 day to gain full control. And many of the test teams that were able to copy, change, and delete systems data, with one team downloading 100 gigabytes of information. So that's some of the findings.
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, that's absolutely to be expected. And in general, the more you make your weapon system dependent on links with outside data through satellites, through the internet, on things like GPS, which of course is satellite-based, the more you're going to get hacked. And in fact, I know aircraft units, in the Air Force and in the Navy that exercise regularly under the assumption that no satellite will be available and no long-distance communication. That's smart. Those are units run by really smart tacticians because they know our enemies can do that to us. And if their pilots are not ready to deal with that situation of being stripped of all their network links, you know, in a hot second because some enemy has jammed them, if your pilots aren't prepared to do that, you're going to have a terrible time in combat. So out in the field, there are people who are well aware of this and who practice, working without the benefit of all this, computer interconnectedness and so on, because they know it's going to happen to them. But in the meanwhile, we're spending billions and billions on weapons that depend entirely on exactly these computer networks and exactly all this exchange of data among platforms. The more data you exchange among platforms, the more you expose yourself to hacking.
But these planes, as you pointed out, the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in the world, that the fleet's just been grounded, and one recently crashed, that just one bullet could knock the plane down because it's so crammed with sensitive electronics and highly explosive fluids.
Right.
That's the opposite of the plane that you designed, the other plane, apart from the F-16, which was the A-10. Which is still in service. The Air Force has tried to put it out of service, but the military keeps demanding that they need it, and it's been the only airplane that's actually been used extensively in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Let's make sure we know which military is demanding it. There's no high-ranking military that is demanding the A-10.
Uh-huh.
All the high-ranking generals are getting ready for their retirement jobs with the aircraft industry. The aircraft industry hates airplanes as cheap as the A-10. The military that wants it are the guys whose lives are being saved, privates and corporals and sergeants on the ground, and of course, pilots who are committed to the mission of saving guys on the ground. So at low levels, you have tremendous demand for the A-10, the guys who have to use it and the guys who have to survive the next big fight.
And the the girls too. One of them is
a
U.S. senator, right?
She's a
Kelly Ayotte
running for the Senate.
Yeah, sorry, Kelly Ayotte's husband was
right.
Yeah,
right.
But
exactly.
One of them's running for the Senate down in up in New Jersey.
And by the way, some of the very best A-10 pilots are women. I know three of them that are very impressive women indeed.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that the demand for keeping the A-10 and not trashing it immediately into the boneyard, which is what all the generals want to do, is all at very low levels at people who actually, have to fight the wars and risk their lives to do so. The Air Force itself has been working, seriously working to kill the entire A-10 fleet since 2012.
It's just mind-boggling, isn't it?
The chief of staff in 2012 came in with the mission of killing the A-10. That was General Welch. And he's now happily on the board of Northrop as a board of directors, enjoying, extremely good salary and perks that are even larger than his salary. And
well,
he happened to have been chief of staff during the time when Northrop got this latest B-21 $100 billion contract. That gives you a sense of why we don't get good airplanes.
Well, Pierre Spray, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Enjoyed it as always. Carry on, I.
Thanks a lot. We'll talk again, I suspect. And again, I've been speaking with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and system designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet, and he left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how the Internet has become the new battlefield in the 21st century. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. And his latest book, co-authored with Emerson Booking, just out, is Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. They also have an article at Wired magazine, How the Kavanaugh Information War Mirrors Real War Zones. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Singer.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter, I find it extraordinary, in a way not surprising, that the Russians developed hybrid warfare as they have done, because Putin's facing, after Crimea and his involvement in Ukraine, he's facing all these sanctions. I don't believe his military can do much. In fact, probably what's happening in Ukraine is he's creating a guerrilla army against him if he were ever to push forward. But it seems like he's figured out that this kind of non-kinetic warfare is both an effective way to retaliate against his perceived sense that NATO's encroaching on him and the Americans are manipulating all of these colored revolutions, etc. So it just seems that there's a certain logic to it, that if you can mess with us without firing a shot, that's a pretty good deal.
You've got it exactly. It's not all that surprising that Russia has been ahead in the game of what we call like war, this idea of hacking not the networks, which is commonly referred to as cyber war, but hacking the people on the networks by driving ideas viral through a mix of like and lies. Russia's been at this game of disinformation, dating back to the origin of the Soviet Union in the 1920s. In fact, they come up with the term disinformation as a means of almost spreading disinformation about the idea itself. So they've been at this for a long time. What's important to understand is that their vision of propaganda is not making you like me. It's not, blue jeans or rock and roll music or the like. It's rather about spreading dissension, division, distrust. And that's the consistency that's gone through everything from back in the 1920s to what they did in the Cold War to the more recent campaigns, targeting Brexit, the U.S. election in 2016, and before the 2018. The difference, though, is with social media, with the internet, they can do it with a speed and a spread and a scope that was previously unimaginable. So there were KGB campaigns that we talk about, back in the Cold War period, where it would take them 4 years to put it together, and it would hit tens of thousands of people, and you compare that to the way that they could drive, just one single story viral with tens of millions of people reading it, and it would take them less than a day. And, this is the game change, where it's allowed authoritarian governments to, in essence, export censorship. But the kind of censorship is not blocking people from the truth, but rather burying the truth underneath a sea of lies.
But we invented these platforms. That's what I find extraordinary. We invented the means by which they've turned these platforms against it. So having invented the internet and having all of these companies like Facebook, Amazon, Google, Apple, etc., here in Silicon Valley, can you make a case that somehow we dropped the ball?
Oh, I think you definitely can. in fact, we, the inventors of the internet, we're now the nation that other nations point to of the don't let that happen to you. We're the victim that they use in instruction. And this is whether it's in military circles to politics or the like, if you're in Sweden or whatnot. And we talk about this in the book, but it also points to we shouldn't view this as a hopeless task. There's actually a series of things that other nations have done to better protect themselves from this kind of targeting. And unsurprisingly, some of the best at it are the nations that were along Russia's borders, the Estonias, the Swedes, and the like. And what they've done is quite similar to what's played out in cybersecurity, where you go back about 10 years ago, we start to understand that there's new online threats. And we change everything from how our military looks at the threats to how the rest of government organizes, but also to how private business and even you and I as individuals think about the threats to, like, our email accounts, our bank accounts, et cetera. We learn, we catch up, we reorganize. The same thing needs to happen in this space. And, you know, the measures that have been taken by the Estonians of the world can be taken by the United States. We just have to understand the nature of the problem and go after it. It also points to the role that you and I can play. There's a whole new level of digital literacy that we need, whether it's our kids, who, you know, fall prey to conspiracy theory, fake news, disinformation online, even though they've grown up in this world of social media, all the way up to baby boomers who have been particularly susceptible to some of the worst viral misinformation outbreaks. There's very simple approaches that we can all take to better protect ourselves. I liken it almost to the game of poker. There's the old movie Rounders, and it had the line that if you're sitting down at the poker table and you don't know who the mark is, you're the mark. It's the same thing with a lot of us online right now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. And his latest book, co-authored with Emerson Booking, just out, is Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. They also have an article at Wired Magazine, How the Kavanaugh Information War Mirrors Real War Zones. But I think this points to a broader problem that we have here in the United States, which is that there's no consensus about what is true and what is real. And you have this phenomenon known as reality shopping, where liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian television, and we're all in these silos. And Facebook, where I think two-thirds of Americans get their news from, they share the same information amongst their like-minded friends. So little wonder we're vulnerable.
And that's where social media has added to this problem. It reinforces an idea known as homophily, love of self. And online, we basically seek out people who think like us, and we cluster into little communities, and then our information sources reinforce that. And that will, it's a very natural human thing to do that has been reinforced by the attention economy that these companies are structured along, where, you know, they make money off of our interaction, our clicks, the ads that steer towards us. And so essentially, we're going to have to come after that with both how we restructure the attention economy, but also the way that you and I lead our lives online. And the solution, there's a lot of different online things we can do, but many of them echo some of the oldest lessons of literally human history. One of the oldest lessons is the idea of the 10 men, the 10 blind men and the elephant, and how each of them touching the elephant thinks that they've found the truth. You know, one thinks it's a wall, another thinks it's a snake. And it's only by bringing all of the different experiences together that you can get at the actual truth, at the actual reality. And it's the same thing online, that if we're pulling from just one information source, if we're staying within our bubble, we will, of course, only have one truth, which is not the actual truth.
But I don't see us ever returning to the days of Uncle Walter Cronkite reading the news and everybody in the country accepting that that is the reality. Whereas now you've got Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts, which are being exploited by this White House. And, of course, the Russians under Putin, his what he called a political technologist, Surkov, came up with all of this idea. There was a wonderful book written about how Putin basically has captured the minds of the Russians, even though he's stealing them blind. Nothing is true and everything is possible. So that's the situation we have. And, of course, as your book makes it clear, and your book is not about so much about warfare, it's about how social media is affecting us broadly and how the internet has become the new battlefield of the 21st century. So given that, I mean, we don't have a BBC, we don't have an institution we trust anymore. As I say, the best example I could come up with was Walter Cronkite back in the day when most people watched him or his equivalent on NBC and ABC. Those days are over. So, how do you bring them back?
Yes, they are over, and we're not going back to them. That is a reality that we have to accept. The great and scary thing of this space is the disruptive effect that it's had in eliminating the role of many gatekeepers. And, you know, one would have been back in the day of, you know, television empowers a new person and empowers an anchor man who that single person can help decide the outcome of a conflict. You know, famously, Cronkite turns on the Vietnam War and LBJ cries that he's lost the war because he's lost Cronkite. Well, now, you know, the gatekeepers, you and I and pretty much anyone can tell their own story online. And this could be both for the good and the bad. As an example, in the book, we have these characters, two little girls under the age of 10, that perfectly illustrate this shift. One is a little girl in Pennsylvania who her town has lost its newspaper because of social media. It's no longer can a newspaper thrive in a small town. They can't make enough money. So she decides to start her own online newspaper. And it's a fun story. She originally reports on the birth of her baby brother. You know, not that many people are reading about it. But then she goes on to report on things like a corruption case in the city government to, she reports the first murder in the town in a generation. She's under the age of 10. It's this wonderful, cool story of kind of how you can be empowered by the online world. But the flip side is we parallel that with another story of a little girl, in, the Palestinian territories. Her name is Dana Jihad, and she's basically become an information warrior. She seeks out violence, both to cover it, but also to push a point of view. And she describes how this is her weapon now. And so, again, you see both sides of it. So if we're not going to go back to a world of gatekeepers, we have to understand the duality. And then most important, what's different about social media is each of us individually have the power. Our clicks, our likes decide which of these sides went out, whether it's for the good or the bad, whether it's for the toxic side or it's the people pushing for human rights and the like. We decide what will play out. And I would argue we're really at an inflection point right now, not just in our political history, but also in how the technology companies themselves are going to handle what's going on in their spaces. You know, it's become the nervous system of the modern world, but it's also become a battle space. And they're, in turn, developing their own policies for what to do about it. It's a really exciting time, but I go back to this notion of we can't expect to handle it right. We can't expect to navigate this world if we don't understand the basic rules. And that's really what we tried to accomplish with this, is teach the new rules of the game so that we can better not just protect ourselves, but become these better citizens online that reward the good and punish the bad.
But the flip side of the stories that you just told us, Peter Singer, is what happened after the Malaysian airliner was shot down by the Russians on the Ukrainian border. And it was a horrendous thing. But immediately Russian operatives edited Wikipedia's entry for MH17, and they tried to put out their version of alternative history. And frankly, a number of my colleagues bought into the idea that somehow the Ukrainians had shot the plane down. So that, again, gets back to my point that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, Wikipedia, that's an American platform invented and started by Americans, and yet it's being used against us.
You're trying to depress me here, Ian, but again, that example, it's in the book, it shows both sides, right? And it's an utterly fascinating example. So you hit it exactly right. There is a shoot down of a Malaysian airliner, And essentially, Russia tries to bury the truth underneath a sea of lies. Wikipedia becomes a battleground of trying to plant false stories. And they're not just pushing out one counter narrative, they're pushing out many of them. You know, everything from there was another plane that shot it down to no, it was a Ukrainian missile that shot it down from below. And literally, they're simultaneously coming up with contradictory stories, but they're just trying to push out all of these different stories and make people just distrust anything and everything. And there's a wonderful parallel that's even played out in the recent Kavanaugh debate for the Supreme Court hearing, where Wikipedia, during the hearing, became a battleground where people were trying to plant false evidence of things that try and prove the veracity of certain statements he had made that were not true, et cetera. So, yes, it's that. But the very same incident shows the new positive power, because the reason we know Russian shot down that airliner is not just because you read a CIA report or something like that. It's that a group of basically work from home Sherlock Holmes pieced together using little digital clues that had been left online, social media imagery, reports and the like, and this network of online volunteers were able to not just prove that Russia shot down the airliner, not just identify which Russian military unit did it, 53rd Anti Aircraft Brigade, not just which missile truck fired it, but the names and personal identities of the Russian soldiers that pulled the trigger. So this group of volunteers, solely scanning what's online, were able to document the largest war crime in European history in the last generation. So again, it shows both sides of it that's there. It's utterly fascinating. And again, it can tilt one way or the other. We help decide that.
Right, and Bellingcat, which is a private security company in the UK.
No, not private. It's again this kind of new form. It's a group of who are sort of like a news agency, sort of like an intelligence group, mm-hmm. but they're also just a group of volunteers. You know, one of them we met and talked to, he's tracking down Russian war crimes online, but he lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. His in-laws think he's screwing around on the computer, and yet he's, part of some of the most important stories that are out there. They recently, for example, documented the Russian role in the poisoning of the individuals in Great Britain. But he's doing this, he describes, he rarely leaves the house except to go get a Chipotle burrito. This is the right. new world we're in. It's right. so well, cool. It's so exciting. So it's a little bit scary.
Well, that's why I brought up Bellingcat, because they identified the Russians who poisoned the Skripals. And so,
yes.
Well, Peter Sanger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks again for having me.
And I've been speaking with Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Cybersecurity and Cyberwar, What Everyone Needs to Know. And his latest book, co-authored with Emerson Booging, just out, is Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. They also have an article in Wired magazine, How the Kavanaugh Information War Mirrors Real War Zones. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.